Of course, learn a great deal about the character and the nature of God. We're told, for instance, back in the book of 1 John, chapter 4 and verse 8, that God is love. We learn also in 1 John 5:3 that this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments. We learn that love is the fulfilling of the law. So we see various scriptures that focus us in on who and what God is. God is love. That God is love personified. God's way, God's law is the reflection of that love. And we talk about allowing Christ to live in us. Jesus Christ, of course, said that the works which, you know, I've seen the Father do, that's what I do. He said, I and my Father are one. We are totally united. Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now, what commandments, of course, did Christ give? Well, you know, a lot of people think that the commandments that God gave back in the Old Testament and recorded in Exodus chapter 20, that those were the Father's commandments. And somehow Christ came along and He did away with those commandments. Well, I think we can very clearly prove, very easily, very simply, that Jesus Christ was the one that was actually the one that spoke those commandments back on Mount Sinai, recorded back in Exodus chapter 20. We find, for instance, just notice very briefly, we can prove, Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now, which commandments did Christ speak? Well, notice, John chapter 5, verse 37. The Father himself, which has sent me, is borne witness of me. You have neither heard his voice at any time or seen his shape. Now, we're told right here in John 5, 37, that nobody has heard the Father's voice. Christ said, you have neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his shape. And yet, when we go back to Exodus chapter 20, let's notice, Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the eternal your God, going right on down. And in the conclusion of that, in verse 19, that they, the people, said unto Moses, speak you with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. Now, we find here, according to Exodus chapter 20, that God is the one that spoke the words of the Ten Commandments. And yet, according to John chapter 5 and verse 37, the Father has not, no one has heard the Father's voice. They did not hear the voice of the Father. And yet, they heard the voice of God. Well, whose voice did they hear then? Well, according to John 1:1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. The Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him. Without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was light. The light was the light of men. Then we come on down in verse 14. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Now, here we find that the Word was God. The Word, the Logos, the spokesman. When we come on down to verse 14, it becomes very evident that the one that is called the Word here in John chapter 1 is, of course, none other than Jesus Christ. So, when Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments, which commandments did Christ speak? Well, Jesus Christ spoke the commandments that are recorded in Exodus chapter 20. Those are not just the Father's commandments, and Christ came and did away with them and introduced a new set. Those were the commandments Jesus Christ gave. The law of God. We're told, as we saw in 1 John, God is love. Love is the fulfilling of the law of God. We're told in 1 John 3, 4, that sin is the transgression of the law. So God's law, basically summarized in 10 basic points, tell us the way that God is. They summarize for us, they define for us the character of God, the nature of God, the way of God, the mind of God, the way that God thinks, that Jesus Christ is going to live His life in us. How's He going to live? What's He going to do? Well, it's going to be based on a reflection of that law, of that nature of God. Now, that basic law, which again, we went into at the time of Pentecost, we went into the aspects of the Old and the New Covenant, the fact that God made a covenant, a marriage covenant with ancient Israel, that God has made a marriage covenant with the church. What is the basis of the covenant? Well, the basis of the covenant is the law of God. They were called, the two tables of stone on which the Ten Commandments were written and inscribed, were called the tables of the covenant. They were placed in a great ark, which was called the Ark of the Covenant. And that, of course, in fact, there's a statement back in 2 Chronicles 5:10. Has anyone ever asked you, what did Moses put in the ark? You know, you think it's a joke. No, Moses didn't put anything in the ark. Noah did. And that's what you think. Well, you're wrong. Notice 2 Chronicles 5:10. There was nothing in the ark except the two tables of stone which Moses put therein at Horeb when the Eternal made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Now, obviously, of course, there's two different arks, and usually you hear the statement, you know, what was put in the ark. But you think about Noah in the ark, and the ark that he built and put the animals in and all of this. Well, you know, there was another ark, and it was a different kind of ark. It wasn't a boat, it was a float, it was a box. It was, you know, something that, well, it was a container. And Moses built that ark. See, Moses built an ark too, a different kind of an ark than what Noah built. And Moses put something in his ark. Now, what Moses put in the ark was the two tables of stone, which he put therein at Horeb, or Sinai, when the Eternal made a covenant. Now, you know what that ark was called? As you read of it through the Scriptures, it was called what? It was called the Ark of the Covenant. Called the Ark of the Covenant. But the reason it was called the Ark of the Covenant is because what did it have in it? It had the two tables of stone which contained the basis of the covenant. The two tables of stone which contained the law of God, the Ten Commandments. That is the basis of the covenant. You see? God put that, had Moses put that in the Ark of the Covenant. These were the tables of the covenant put therein at Mount Sinai. So we were focusing last week and in some of the preceding weeks, we were focusing on the covenant that God has made with His people, the fact that we enter into that covenant relationship, and the fact that through God giving us His Holy Spirit, He begins to write His laws in our hearts and in our minds. That law, of course, again, is summarized back in Exodus chapter 20, as well as, of course, Deuteronomy 5, in 10 basic points. Christ, of course, summed it up, saying, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two, He said, hang all the law and the prophets. This is what everything else is about. But these two basic points are further summarized, further amplified. Loving God is amplified in the first four commandments. Loving your neighbor is amplified in the latter six. And then each of those 10 commandments, each of those 10 points, is further amplified throughout the remainder of the Bible. We're going to begin a process of going through and focusing on that basic law of God, point by point. And I think we're going to understand as we go through and as we focus over a period of time on various points of the basic law of God, I think we're going to begin to realize more deeply how totally all-encompassing is the law of God and how these commandments, which reflect the mind and the nature and the character of God, which are based on the love of God, and which instruct us how to love God and how to love one another. We're to receive God's Spirit and have God inscribing His character, His nature in us, Jesus Christ living His life in us, then we need to understand a little more clearly the basic law of God. That's what we're going to begin going through. It's going to take a while. Maybe other subjects will be entered first. But we're going to begin to go through God's law and to understand how it affects us and what it has for us. And I want us today to focus on the very first commandment and to understand more clearly what God means. Well, today, let's go back and let's focus on God's commandments. Let's focus on the first commandment. Notice back in Exodus chapter 20, of course, you know the setting. God has brought the people together. They are gathered there at Mount Sinai. The mountain quakes and shakes. There's fire and thunder and smoke that proceeds out of the top of the mountain. The people are literally petrified because they are to hear the voice of God. And of course, the voice of the one that became Jesus Christ. So we read in Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, "And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the eternal your God, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other God before me." That is the first commandment. God said, I am the eternal your God. You shall have no other God before me. Well, brethren, as we go through and as we understand that commandment and understand how the full implications of this commandment in our lives, what it means for us, we need to understand more clearly, to begin with, who is the true God? Who is the God that spoke these words, that said, you shall have no other God before me? Because if you don't know who the true God is, then how do you know if you're worshiping a false God? How do you know if you're serving a false God? The only way you can know, you know, is to know who the real thing is. Who the real God, the true God is. Understanding God as He reveals Himself in the Scriptures. And then we can begin to look and see and realize that there are many false gods. They also parade under the name of God. And people talk about the God that they serve. Scriptures talk about the God of this world. And there is a God of this world whom people serve in ignorance, thinking that they're serving the true God. Yet we're told back in James chapter 4 and verse 12, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. James 4:12, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. That is, of course, the true God. The true God is the source of law. Now, what is your source of law? What is the source of your standards, of your values, of your concepts? You know, this entire Bible is filled up with the law of the God that is described as the one lawgiver, the true lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Now, why is God able to be the one lawgiver? Well, we're introduced to God. You know, God is the first thing we're introduced to when you pick up the Bible. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, we're introduced to God. We're introduced to God, the Creator. God is the one that fashioned and formed the universe. We go through the story in detail, and I'm not going to go through it in detail today. I think we've done so in times past, and undoubtedly can in the future. In Genesis chapter 1, going through an understanding about creation. But God is the Creator. God is the one that designed and created the physical universe that we see. God is the one that designed and created the first man and breathed the breath of air into his nostrils. God is the Creator. And because God is the Creator, because God formed and fashioned the earth. You know, and you can go through the Psalms, and it talks about how that the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows His handiwork. How that as we gaze up at the heavens which God has created, at the stars which His fingers framed and formed. We're able to consider the greatness of God, the power of God. We read that it is the glory of God to conceal a thing and the honor of kings to search it out. And of course, as man has increased in his knowledge and his understanding, he's come to understand and to, in a sense, unravel some of the secrets of the universe, by no means all. We've only just barely tipped the iceberg. We began to understand a little bit about the marvelous wisdom and intricacy that God has designed and created and fashioned. But God is the creator. God is the life giver. God is the one that formed and fashioned the things that we see. And so, therefore, God set in motion law. When God created the physical universe, when God made the heavens and the earth, God set in motion laws. He set in motion laws that govern the rotation of planets, the revolution of planets around the sun, the revolution of the moons around the planets, their own rotation on their own axis. God set in motion laws, all the laws of science that we know of, and plenty of laws that we don't know of. You know, science didn't invent the law. Science hangs a name on it. They finally discovered something that God set in motion billions of years ago. And all of a sudden, we think that we've really come up with something. Well, no, we didn't come up with something. God came up with something. We're just now finding out what it was. But God set in motion law. And God gave laws for human beings. God gave laws. God gave standards that define what is right and what is wrong. Now, in understanding who the true God is, what does it mean? I am the eternal, your God. I brought you out of the house of bondage. I brought you out of the land of Egypt. I freed you. You shall have no other gods before me, or, as it could be rendered, no other gods in place of me. What is a God? Notice Romans chapter 6 and verse 16. It defines that for us. It tells us what is a God. What is our God? Romans 6:16. Know you not to whom you yield yourselves servants to obey? His servants you are to whom you obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. Whoever you obey, to whom do you give your allegiance? Who do you follow? Who do you honor? Who do you extol? Who do you worship? Who comes first in your life? That's your God. The true God, that is the one lawgiver who is able both to save and to destroy, has set in motion certain laws. Now, the world as a whole does not pay heed to those laws. Society does not recognize those laws. Society wants to go its own way and do its own thing. It doesn't recognize the true God. It does not recognize the laws that that God has set into motion. That's why, up a little bit further, we're told in James chapter 4 and verse 4, you adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever, therefore, shall be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. You know, the true God is set in motion law. The world is flouting those laws, flaunting those laws, flaunting its disobedience to those laws. Now, we demonstrate by our conduct, by the way that we live our lives, by the values that are apparent. Because you see, what we see on the outside is simply a reflection of what is on the inside. You can change up the outward appearance. You can change up certain things about the outside and do so temporarily and maybe look pretty good. You know, the Pharisees went through the motions of some of that. They cleansed the outside of the cup and of the saucer. They looked pretty good on the outside in terms of outward appearance, outward conformity to certain laws of God. But on the inside, they were, you know, ravening wolves. Now, we're told, Christ said, out of the abundance of the heart, a man speaks. You know, what we are on the inside, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. What are we tuned into? Are we tuned in to the friendship of the world? Are we enamored by the values and the customs of this society? You know, these things show up. They show up whether in very outward physical forms, whether it's the styles of just all the type of things that go on. You know, there have been various comments before, whether it about the different things, the standards that God sets in His Word, the way that His people are to act, to look, to comport themselves. And yet, sometimes we want to get as close to the world. We want to get as close to the edge as we can get. We're enamored with a friendship of the world. We don't want to be different. We don't want to stand out. We don't want to be a peculiar people. We want to blend in. We want to look like, act like, be as close to the world as we can. A friendship with the world. And at the end that he was done. There's one lawgiver who is the Creator. There are many who attempt to be a lawgiver, to set standards and customs, the values of society. And this society places its values in every way, and they're an upside-down value. When you look at personal relationships, God says, men be men, men be masculine. Women be feminine. Society turns it around. You want to go for the unisex look. You know, men, grow your hair long. Not like God said. Women, act masculine. Behave in an aggressive form. Society has its own values. And they downplay and they contradict every value that God has set. You can go into every aspect of it. So, God is the true God. He's the Creator. He defines Himself as the possessor of heaven and earth. You know, when we read the story in Genesis 14, when Abraham, we have the account of Abraham tithing. And this is, tithing is introduced in Genesis 14 not as something new, not as some law that God all of a sudden invented and told Moses and told Abraham about. But it's something, it is simply introduced as an ongoing practice that after Abram had returned from the slaughter of the kings, Genesis 14:18, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, tithe of all. Abraham tithes here is an ongoing practice, an ongoing custom, not something that was invented or added at this time. And he tithes to God in the context that God was the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. So the true God, the God that we're to serve, the God that is the author of the Ten Commandments, the God whose law that we read of in this book, that law is a reflection of His love. That God is the Creator. That God is the lawgiver. That God is the possessor of heaven and earth. Now, in the context of being the possessor of heaven and earth, we first read of the mention of tithing, which recognizes, of course, that God is the owner of everything. That's why we're told in many places, well, notice Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 9. Honor the eternal with your substance and with the first fruits of all your increase. So shall your barns be filled with plenty, your presses shall burst out with new wine. You know, recognize that God is the possessor of heaven and earth. Recognize that God is the owner of everything. And honor that God with the first fruits of your increase. Honor that God with what belongs to Him. Now, there are many prerogatives that God expresses. There are many things about God that define who God is. You know, God reveals himself through us through his reveals himself to us through his name. God uses many names in the scriptures. The word that is translated Lord in all capital letters in the King James Bible is always spelled in all caps, you'll notice it, as opposed to Lord that is spelled just normally with lowercase letters as well. But where the word Lord in the King James is printed in all capital letters, it comes from the Hebrew word Yahweh, the Hebrew YHWH. And the word literally means the eternal one, the self-existent one, the one with life inherent in himself, the one who, you know, was and is to be. The eternal, probably the most succinct way of putting it, the most succinct translation into English, but the eternal, ever-living, self-existent one with life inherent in himself. That's really what the term means. God presents himself as that. That tells you a little bit about God. God is eternal. God possesses life. We're told that God inhabits eternity. So God is the life giver. God possesses life. God then reveals himself through various names, which reflect various attributes, various characteristics of God. Now, in order to know that we are serving the true God, the God, the Lord High God, the eternal God, the possessor of heaven and earth, the creator, we have to understand a little bit of who that God is. We have to understand some of his attributes, some of his characteristics, some of the things that God possesses, the abilities that God possesses. Because only by knowing who the true God is and understanding that God are we able to understand that we're truly fulfilling the first commandment. God reveals himself, as I say, through various names. Exodus chapter 15, God reveals himself through a name. Exodus chapter 15, verse 26, he said, God said, if you will diligently hearken to the voice of the eternal your God and will do that which is right in his sight and will give ear to his commandments and will keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon you which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the eternal that heals you. Or as it is in the Hebrew, I am Yahweh Rophika. I am the eternal your healer. Now that's one of God's names. That's part of who God is. That's who the true God is. He is God the creator. He is God the lawgiver. He is God the possessor of heaven and earth. He is God, our healer. Now, when we go back, for instance, to Psalm 103, we find that healing is mentioned in the context of one of the benefits God gives his people. He tells us in Psalm 103, you know, to honor God, to praise the Lord, O my soul. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the eternal, O my soul. And forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases. God is Yahweh Rophika. God is God, our healer. Healing is presented here as one of the benefits that the people of God may partake of. It is a blessing. It is something that we have available to us. Because of the great God, the God who loves us, who gave for us his only begotten Son, who emptied himself, divested himself, made himself a sacrifice for us. God reveals himself as God our healer. God cares for us. God watches out for us. God is the one that we can go to in time of need, in time of help. He's the one in whom we need to put our trust and our confidence. We're told, for instance, in Psalm 18. Psalm 18 and verse 1, I will love you, O eternal, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my strength. In whom will I trust? My buckler, the horn of my salvation, my high tower. I will call upon the eternal who is worthy to be praised, so shall I be saved from my enemies. So God is here. We learn a little bit more about God. Who is the true God? God is our source of strength. God is our rock. He is our stalwart support. So He's a rock, not a piece of crumbling sand. He's a rock. He's our fortress. Our protection. Who is our protector? Where do you put your trust? What do you look to? My deliverer, my God, my strength. In whom will I trust? My buckler. The horn of my salvation. My high tower, my refuge. God is the one that we can look to as our protector, our provider. Notice on over in Psalm 23. Here's the true God. Here's who the true God is. The Lord is my shepherd. He's the one that shepherds us, that looks out for us, that cares for us more deeply than we can even begin to comprehend, more deeply than we as human beings can even love and care for and cherish our own children. The Lord is my shepherd. Now, what's the result of that? What does that mean to say that the eternal God is my shepherd? The result of that is that I shall not want. You know, what was one of the main jobs of the shepherd? Well, one of the main jobs of the shepherd was to feed the sheep, right? You know, if sheep starve to death, the shepherd obviously wasn't doing his job. Why do you have a shepherd? Well, you have a shepherd to watch the sheep, to protect the sheep, to feed the sheep, to care for the sheep. We're told here, the eternal is my shepherd. The result of that is I shall not want. I'm not going to be in need because I've got a shepherd that I can look to. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. You know, God leads us. He leads us into the good area. Now that term, He leads me beside the still waters or the waters of quietness. He restores my soul, my life. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you, God, the God who is our shepherd, are with me. Your rod, your staff, they comfort me. Where do we look to in time of need? Where do we look in time of trouble, in time of difficulty? Where do we look when we need help? To the God who is our shepherd? To the God who says we don't ever have to walk alone? And if we walk alone, it's my choice. God leads us in the paths of righteousness. Now, when we veer off the paths of righteousness and are going our own way, we're going to persist in our own way, and we're not going to follow the path where God leads, then yes, we might walk alone. So God is our shepherd, and God will lead us, God will guide us, and we're willing to follow in the paths that He leads us. We don't ever have to walk alone, and it doesn't matter through what we have to go. It doesn't matter the valley of the shadow of death. It doesn't matter how sore the trial. We're not alone. We don't face it by ourselves. I'll fear no evil. You're with me. Your rod, your staff, your protection comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the eternal forever. I'll be where God is. I want to be where God is. God is our shepherd. The one who cares for us, the one who leads us, the one who guides us, who provides for us, the one who sees that we never have to walk alone. God is our Father, and He loves us more tenderly than we as human parents can even love our own children. Jesus Christ showed us in Matthew chapter 6 that we're to address God as our Father, that we're to recognize God in this area. We're told, for instance, in Matthew chapter 6, verse 8, Be not ye therefore like unto them, those who use vain repetitions, who, you know, go on and on and on with their little chants and rituals. Be not therefore like unto them, for your Father knows what things you have need of before you ask. After this manner, therefore, pray. In this way, following this basic outline, our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be your name. We're told to address God as our Father, realizing that God loves us. God watches over us. He is our Father. He does care for us. He loves us. He stands ready to give us good gifts. So when we're told that we're not to have any other God before the true God, who is the true God? Well, the true God is the one that is the creator. He is the one that is the lawgiver. He is the one that is the possessor of heaven and earth. He is the God that is our healer. He is the God that is our protector and our provider, our maker, our shepherd, our Father, the God who loves us and cares for us, the God who is our source of help in time of need, who is our refuge in time of trouble. The true God, the God of the Bible, the Creator and the Lawgiver. Now, as a nation, we don't recognize that God as a nation, the physical descendants of the people to whom those words were first spoken. We have placed another God before the true God. In fact, we've placed many gods before the true God. We don't serve the true God. We don't recognize the God that is the Creator. You know, we've taken God out of every facet of our national life, with one exception. The only thing we have left is we print on our money, in God we trust. And you know, that's about the only thing that's holding it together. And God's not going to keep doing that. Kind of ironic. Of course, that is really the God that most people trust in. Their money. We're going to focus on that a little bit later. Notice just briefly in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 2. Notice how God indicts our nation. God says in Jeremiah, chapter 2, verse 11, has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? You know, have the pagans changed their pagan gods? Oh, no, you know, they hold on to them. I mean, the Buddhists are still Buddhists. You know, they still follow the teachings of Buddha. And the Confucianists, in their confusion, still follow the teachings of Confucius. Hindus, you know, still follow their religion. The Muslims follow theirs. Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? No. But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be astonished, O you heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid, be you very desolate, says the Eternal, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. God says, my people have forsaken me, the source of living waters. God draws an analogy comparing himself like a fountain, an artesian well, a never-ending source and supply of good, fresh water. God says, you know, I'm the source of everything you need. And yet the people, as a nation, we've forsaken God, the true God, the source of everything we need. And we've hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns, which can hold no water. You know, a cistern is not a real good source of water at the best of times. A broken cistern is just not worse than nothing, because it can't even hold any water. You know, a cistern doesn't have any water in it except what you put in it, or what collects from rainfall. So, you know, it's easily used up, easily evaporated. It doesn't last all that long. Depending on you, you have to be pretty sparing when your only source of water is a cistern. sorts of waters and artesian well, you've got a seemingly never-ending supply. God says as a nation, we've rejected the true God and we've gone after a false God. Notice back in the law of God. Notice back in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18. Notice what God instructed our forefathers. Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 21. God said, you shall not let any of your seed pass through the fire to Molech. Neither shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Eternal. You shall not let any of your seed, any of your children, pass through the fire to Molech. Now let's go on back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Let's notice similar statements. Deuteronomy chapter 12, let's pick it in verse 29. Well, let's start on up in verse 28. Observe and hear all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do that which is good and right in the sight of the Eternal your God, when the Eternal your God shall cut off the nations from before you where you go to possess them, and you succeed them and dwell in their land. Take heed to yourself that you be not snared by following them after that they be destroyed from before you, and that you inquire not after their God, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. And we'll pick up the customs of the nation, and we'll call them by God's name. You shall not do so unto the Eternal your God, for every abomination of the Eternal which he hates have they done unto their gods, for even their sons and their daughters have they burnt in the fire to their gods. What things soever I command you, observe to do it, and you shall not add thereto, nor take away, nor diminish therefrom. Now the nations of old sacrificed their children to their gods. God told his people, he said, don't make your children pass through the fire to Molech. Don't sacrifice your children to false gods. Israel of old did that. Notice in the book of Isaiah, chapter 2. Isaiah, chapter 2, and verse 7. Let's notice, picking it up, Isaiah 2, let's pick it up in verse 6. Therefore, you have forsaken, you, God, have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east, or they be full of divination from the east, and are soothsayers, like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers. We've gone after astrology, we've gone after the great wisdom of the east. Notice verse 7, their land also is full of silver and gold, and there's never been a nation that is more full of silver and gold, that is more full of material wealth than our nation. Their land also is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land also is full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots. Get out on the freeway, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and you'll understand there is no end of their chariots. Certainly, I think we can realize that here in this area. You know, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land also is full of idols. Now, what are these idols? They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. We worship the work of our hands. Do we as a nation do that? Is our land full of material things? Is it full of treasures? Do we worship the works of our own hands, the things that our own fingers have made? Do we worship materialism? We as a nation serve the God of materialism. Jesus Christ made the statement in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. No man can serve two masters. You can't serve two gods. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. The word mammon simply means money. It means physical riches. You cannot serve God and materialism. You can't serve two masters. Now, in this nation, we don't serve two masters. We serve one master. And that master that this nation serves is the God of materialism. What about God's commandment, you shall not cast your seed through the fire to Molech? You shall not sacrifice your children to false gods. Have we in America sacrificed our children on the altar of materialism? I think so. The evidence of this kind of thing, what we've done, what we've allowed as a nation, very striking. There's an article in the Christian Science Monitor back several years ago. The title of the article is "The Real Culprit Found in the War Against Drug Abuse." Found the real culprit. After years of experimentation, research, sometimes pure guesswork, a number of professionals in the war against drug abuse have concluded the problem is not drugs after all. The real culprit, these professionals believe, are alienation, boredom, loneliness, and low self-esteem. As a result, in a growing number of suburban American communities, we've named several, trying to start various widely divergent drug prevention programs designed to remove the root cause of drug and alcohol abuse. Now, this was written several years ago, and they haven't succeeded because they haven't been able to get at the root of the problem. Now, what they focused on what part of the root of the problem is, but they ran a survey, at least a survey of about 600 suburban high school students, showing about 7 in 10 have a sense of feeling removed, not cared for, generally alienated. He added, this particular expert, that if alienation, loneliness, and boredom are accepted as some of the prime causes of youthful drug abuse, then the study shows the seeds of that problem are not going away, but in fact are expanding. Because, you see, the divorce rate in the United States is the highest in the world. Well, you didn't realize that. The divorce rate in the United States, and this is from an article in Christian Science Monitor back a matter of a few months ago, almost 40% of all marriages today end in divorce. The remarriage rate is high. 4 out of 5 divorced persons remarry. But the divorce rate for remarriages is even higher than for first marriage. What it shows, of course, the people didn't learn. They hadn't learned a lesson. 40% of all the marriages that take place in this country end in divorce. Most of those people, 80% of those people who divorce, turn around and remarry. And the majority of those remarriages, even a higher percentage than the first go-around, the majority of those end in divorce. The number of couples living together out of wedlock has risen dramatically. Today, about 1.3 million unmarried Americans share living quarters with a member of the opposite sex. About 16% of all births in this country are illegitimate today. Now, the figure would undoubtedly be much higher if it were not for abortion, the subject we will get to at a little later time. About 45% of the children born in 1978 will spend part of their childhood with only one parent. Now, I have an idea that the way the statistics are going, the figures are going, you're going to have to revise those upwards. There's been a drastic change. And a lot of it, of course, has gotten back to the climate of materialism in this country. We've sacrificed the American family on the altar of materialism. We've sacrificed our children. We've passed our children through the fire to Molech. We've handed them into the arms of strange gods as a nation. And I could go on and on. I think I'll read a few excerpts. This was a newspaper release, an AP Wire story, back again a few years ago. A Harvard psychiatrist studying emotional illness caused by absent parents said today that separation for even brief periods can have a negative influence. With American parents becoming increasingly more absent because of divorce, jobs, or inability to reach the child emotionally, the future must be regarded with concern. American parents spend less time with their children than any other nation in the world except England. The only country that exceeds the United States in violence, crime, and delinquency. The nation of Israel. Lead the world. The nations to whom God gave His law. The nations to whom God gave the knowledge of the true religion, to whom God revealed Himself as the true God. And we lead the world in divorce, in violence, in crime, in delinquency. We lead the world in degeneracy. We have done worse than the heathen, worse than the nation whom we have replaced. The ever-increasing divorce rate in this country leaves more and more children with an absent parent, and the continuously increasing percentage of mothers who work has left over 6 million preschool children in homes where both parents are absent for most of the day. Who then does the job? In fact, the figures are remarkable. The fact that almost today, and this is more recent, this is, well, in fact, this is a year ago, so this statistic has gone up even since then. Almost 60% of this country's families have two or more wage earners. As a result, fewer people stay home to tend the children, tend the house, and care for the children. Of married women with children under six, the percentage in the labor force in 1979 was 43.2%. which had multiplied four times over since 1950. Of all married women with children ages 6 to 17, 60% now work or seek jobs, up from 28% in 1950. Almost half, in fact, I think this is statistic is about a year old, I think it's probably right at half or pushing half of married women with children under 6 who are in the labor force. They're not, and you know, why is that the case? Well, of course, time after time, the reason is in order to have more, in order to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. We've got, you know, who takes care of the children? What happens? Well, one of the main babysitters is, of course, the television set. According to Nielsen, this is, again, the statistics are a few years old. This is back in 1977. You can figure that all these things have increased since that time. According to the A.C. Nielsen, children under five watch an average of 24 hours of television a week. That may be, the effects are potentially enormous. Multiplied out over 17 years. This rate of viewing means that by his high school graduation, today's typical teenager will have logged at least 15,000 hours before the small screen, more time than he will have spent on any other activity except sleep. Present levels of advertising and mayhem, he will have been exposed to 350,000 commercials and vicariously participated in 18,000 murders. Well, there are various things that can go on. I'm not going to go into all of it. But the point is that as a nation, we have sacrificed our children, we sacrificed our families on the altar of materialism as money and as material things play a greater and a greater role in the desires of our people. The deterioration of the American family has been very marked. You know, you could graph it out, and the charts would run right together, that as material things have been more and more the primary concern and consideration of our people, more and more of the families have broken up, the divorces have increased, children we've been isolated, and our children, as a nation, we sacrifice. And the results are showing. Rising rates of drug abuse and alcoholism among teenagers. The kids that are turned off, tuned out, dropped out from society. Kids that have been involved in everything imaginable. Alienated from their parents, alienated from their family. Left to do their own thing. God talked about in 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, first and foremost, seeking for self. Coming on down in verse 4, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. No man can serve two masters. You can't serve God and materialism. You cannot have two masters that rule your life. It talks about individuals who are lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. The friendship of the world means more than the friendship of God. The physical, temporary, transitory things that this society has to offer mean more than the things that are the result of blessings of God's law. Having a form of godliness, having a form of religion, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Denying the authority. Have we as a nation served false gods? Have we placed another god before the true God? Absolutely. We placed several of them. First and foremost, we place the God of materialism on whose altar we sacrifice our family, into whose arms and through whose fire we cast our children. We destroy as a nation, a generation. Passing them through the fire to Molech, destroying them just as certainly as our forefathers in the valley of Tophet, who took their little infant children and presented them into the brazen arms, big fat idol, with fire burning underneath. We've destroyed in our nation our children, just as certainly, just as surely. We serve another God. We've not recognized God as our protector, as our provider. We've not recognized God as our help in time of need. Back in Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 5, God says, thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Eternal. You know, it was really ironic. Several days ago, there was an article on the front page of the Houston Post, and I don't know how many people really noticed the irony of it all. But there were two main articles that dominated the front page. One of these articles was a speech by President Reagan, spoken at one of the military academies, in which he reiterated our need for more military weaponry to defend this nation, in which he reiterated the need of this nation to pour more and more and more of its resources into the arms race, to build up vast armaments by which we could protect ourselves. And right across the page from this article was another article in which it described one of the worst debacles that has taken place in the history of this country in terms of just a horrible tragedy, of this of over $1 billion worth of damage that was done to all these fighter planes and all this weaponry that was destroyed on this particular ship when the plane crashed. the lives that were lost, the weaponry that was destroyed, the well in excess of $1 billion, almost $2 billion worth of damage that was done to our weaponry, our advanced weaponry. On this carrier off the coast of Virginia. You know, the scripture couldn't help but come to mind here, Jeremiah 17:5. Cursed is the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm, whose heart departs from the eternal. We want to trust what we can do. We want to trust in our armaments and in our missiles. We want to trust in what we humanly can do. Pretty vain, pretty empty. The very day we're calling for more massive government expenditures in the arms field, almost $2 billion worth of arms go up in smoke. Not because the enemy attacked us, but because we, you know, crashed our own plane into our own ship. You depend on human beings, you're in trouble. You know, it's going to take $1 trillion just for ketchup. This was an article in U.S. News and World Report back a short time ago. The biggest peacetime U.S. military buildup in 2 decades is in the works. The concern is rising that there may be too little, too late to check Soviet advance. A 5-year plan calls for more than $1 trillion to increase military pay, buy new ships, warplanes, tanks, weapon systems, and deploy a new nuclear strike force in Europe. The administration's $147 billion spending plan for 1981 is the first installment in a 5-year plan that will, with the impact of inflation, push the 1985 defense budget above $225 billion. The 5-year total to more than $1 trillion. We are rapidly approaching the point where, as was the case during the Vietnam War, 10% of our gross national product is being spent in military and military-related fields. 10%. A tithe. We as a nation are tithing to the God of War. Another place where we sacrifice the cream of the crop of our young manhood. An arm of flesh to whom we've looked for protection. God tells us in the book of Lamentations that he's going to take down the head that he's put around this nation. We're going to realize too late that our protection has come from the great God, the God whose law we have disregarded, the God on whom we have turned our back as a nation. We serve the God of materialism. As a nation, we serve and tithe to the God of War. We sacrifice our children to the God of War, as well as to the God of materialism. You know, there are other gods. We went through and we focused on some of the other, on the various characteristics and attributes of the true God. Of course, one of those, if we focus on the fact that God is our healer. Interesting statement here made in U.S. News and World Report back a short time ago. It says the cost of health care or medical care, I guess, really, you shouldn't say health care, I'll say sickness care, because that's what we do in this nation. The cost of sickness care in the United States is rising at an astronomical rate. There's no relief in sight. Health bills, they're not health bills. People don't, they're not paying for being healthy, they're paying for being sick, are going up faster than those for any other cost of living item, and are taking a dime out of every dollar of the average family's income. Now, what does that tell you? Well, as a nation, we're paying our first tithe. We're also paying a second tithe to a different God. You see, the various gods that we serve as a nation all demand their tithe. This is an interesting statement back in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 1 and verse 2. Ahaziah, who was one of the kings of Israel, fell down through a lattice in his upper chamber that was in Samaria, and he was sick. And he sent messengers, and he said, unto them, Go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover of this disease. Now, Beelzebub, called here, Beelzebub means literally the Lord of flies, or the Lord of what flies hover over. Literally. That's literally the meaning. Beelzebub was the patron saint or the patron god of medicine in the ancient world. And his priests were practitioners. They used various concoctions that often involved flies and the things that flies hovered over, dung, in their various concoctions and in their various remedies. And they were the And this is brought out, by the way, in the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, if you want to look it up. And the Beelzebub was the patron saint, patron god of medicine, and that part of the world. And so Ahaziah said, Go inquire Beelzebub, the god of excellence, whether I shall recover of this disease. But the angel of the Eternal said to Elijah the Tishbite, Arise and go meet the messengers of the king of Samaria, and say unto them, Is it because there is not a god in Israel, that you have gone to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Now therefore, thus says the Eternal, You shall not come down from that bed on which you are gone up, but you shall surely die. And Elijah departed. And when the messengers turned back unto him, he said unto them, Why are you now turned back? They said unto men, unto him, Well, a man came to meet us. He said unto us, Go turn to the king and say, Is it, thus says the Lord, is it because there is not a god in Israel? He sent to inquire Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, therefore you shall not come down from that bed on which you are gone up, but you shall surely die. And he asked him, Well, who was this? And they described him. And he said, Well, it's Elijah the Tishbite. So he sent various groups to try to go get Elijah. And of course, I'm not going to go through the rest of the story. Needless to say, the king died. Now, there are, various other accounts that are given. And that's not the primary thing that I want to get into, except to illustrate the fact that as a nation, we have created our own God, we have thought to other gods. We've not availed ourselves of the God of Israel, the God who is Yahweh Rophi Kah, the God our healer. We've not availed ourselves of the God that is our shield, our fortress, our protector, our high power. We've not availed ourselves of the true God, the God of Israel, as a nation. We've given our allegiance, we've paid our tithe to the god of war, to the god of medicine. And what's going to ravage this nation in a few years, brethren? We're going to be ravaged by disease epidemics, and we're going to be ravaged by military invasion and destruction. And we're going to find that the gods in which we have put our trust and confidence as a nation are going to fail us. God said to ancient Egypt, when he sent the plagues upon Egypt, he said, Against the gods of Egypt will I take vengeance. I'm going to demonstrate to the Egyptians that the gods in which they trust are no gods. And the plagues that God sent on Egypt were aimed at the gods the Egyptians worshipped. The frog, the Nile River, the various animals, all the things that the Egyptians worshipped, God sent a plague on their gods. God is going to allow plagues to come on this nation because God is going to take his hand from this nation. God is going to remove his hedge that he has set around this nation. We're going to get to the point, as it describes in Isaiah 2, where we're going to cast our gold and our silver to the bats and to the moles in the cave. The God of materialism is not going to be able to deliver us. Our treasures, our physical things that we trusted in this nation are not going to be able to deliver us in the day of the Lord. Our military armament, the God of war to whom we paid our tithe and sacrificed our young men, is not going to be able to deliver us in the day of God's visitation. And the God of Mekron, the God of medicine, Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, is not going to be able to deliver us in the day when the plague strikes this nation. And when one-third of the inhabitants of this land die. That's what God says. You can go back to the book of Amos. You can go back to the book of Ezekiel. And God talks about the fact that one third are going to die from the famine and the disease epidemics that are going to sweep this nation. Have we, brethren, as a nation, put another God before the true God? Have we honored and extolled the great God, the Creator God, the one lawgiver that is able to save and to destroy? The great God that brought us out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. The great God who has given us His laws, His standards, His values. Have we as a nation committed two evils? We've rejected God, the source of law, the source of standards, the values of truth, the source of living waters, and we've hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns, cisterns which can hold no water. We sought our own way. There's a way that seems right unto a man. The ends there offer the ways of death. The first commandment. God said, I am the eternal your God, who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other God before me. Brethren, that's the starting point. We need to examine our lives. We need to examine ourselves as we say that we are the people of God, that we are adherents to the covenant of God, that the law of God is being inscribed in our hearts and in our minds through the power of the Spirit of God. We need to examine ourselves. Are we, brethren, as individuals, obeying just even the first commandment? Do we have in our lives any God to come in the place of the true God? To whom do we give our allegiance, our loyalty, our devotion? What's the most important thing in your life? Acceptance by the world? Acceptance by the society around? Your own desires, your own pleasures, your own way? Or, brethren, are we truly seeking to live by every word of God? Are we seeking to serve the true God, the God of Israel, the Creator God, the Lord High God, the Possessor of heaven and earth, the great Creator God? The Lord who is our shepherd, our Father, the God who loves us, and who desires to give us every good thing. That, brethren, is the true God. He holds out many blessings and many benefits. And if we seek it with our whole heart, we will be a partaker of the benefits and the blessings that come from worshiping and serving the true God, the real God.